I am so excited for the following Wild Chat as we finally get to learn more about tree kangaroos. So today's episode is with Dr. Karen Coombs, who is the founder and director of Tree Roo Rescue and can be found up here in North Queensland in a beautiful place called Melanda. And since 1999, she has been rescuing and caring for the Lumholtz tree kangaroos and is now one of your go-to experts. So the following episode, we are going to learn more about exactly how they can live high up in those trees, what adaptations they have, what role they play within our environment. But one of the most important things is further education in how we can try and help protect our Lumholtz tree kangaroos as their numbers are declining drastically. So stay tuned, get your cup of tea ready, because you're going to enjoy the following Wild Chat. Have you ever wondered how a kangaroo can live in a tree? What about crocodiles and how they can stay underwater for hours at a time and not be seen? Maybe what keeps you up at night is your thoughts of how box jellyfish can be the most venomous animal in the whole world towards humans? Or is it your curiosity of what really goes on inside that caterpillar cocoon for a magnificent, stunning butterfly to emerge? Well, don't worry, as I have all your questions answered and much, much more with our following Wild Chats. I am going to bring you the most amazing guests. Hey everyone, my name is Jodie Creek and I'm a wildlife educator and huge advocate for Australian animals. And of course their habitats and ecosystems as well. But what I'm truly passionate about is bringing you information that you need to connect with the natural world. So someone once said to me that I may not be able to change the world, but I can change the world around me. So let's hope that we can inspire you to make change at home, and therefore together we do actually change the world. So get that cup of tea ready and enjoy the following Wild Chats. Ah, hello, Karen. How are you going?
Good, thanks, Jodie. Good morning.
Good morning. I hope you've had your cup of tea or coffee. I actually just quickly made myself a coffee.
Oh, I've already had a couple and I've been running around, so I'm actually back to the glasses of water. So I thought that's enough caffeine for the day.
Well, you would have been up early this morning with the tree kangaroos?
Yeah, I've got two little joeys at the moment, so four hourly feeds. So I was up till midnight and then up again at four, and then they had a feed at eight, and then four hourlies through the day. So in between that, we actually sadly have 28 tree kangaroos in care. So I have one volunteer at the moment, and it's actually sadly a two-person job. So in between feeds, I'm helping clean and feed and look after the tree roos that we have in care.
You must be absolutely buggered.
I am, so I'm glad that your listeners can't see me, because I'm really tired.
Oh, Karen, oh my goodness. Well, everyone's probably wondering a couple of things. One, who are you? What are you talking about? What do you mean by a tree kangaroo? So many people, even in Australia, I'm so surprised, Karen, even in Australia, a lot of people are like, there is no such thing as a tree kangaroo.
Absolutely. When I was doing my PhD, I had family and friends telling me that I was sitting in the rainforest too much. Well, to introduce myself, I'm Dr. Karen Coombs, and I'm the director and founder of an organisation or a rescue sanctuary called Tree Roo Rescue and Conservation Centre. We are here up on the Atherton Tablelands, which is the heartland, I guess you would say, of the Lumholtz tree kangaroo. So yes, tree kangaroos do exist. They are a macropod. They're a kangaroo in every way, except they live in trees. So they're pretty awesome. And as you said, most Australians don't know that they exist. So it's not only my job to rescue those that need attention and care, but it's also my job to educate the world about these absolutely amazing animals.
Oh, absolutely. And so, Karen, what did you do your PhD on?
I did that on the ecology of Lumholtz tree kangaroos.
Okay, yeah, right. That would have taken some time.
It did, and I could have probably spent even more time. So it took me 5 years. I had to catch animals in the forest and follow them, and it actually, they're so hard to find, which is good. When they're hard to find, that's a healthy population. So it took me 18 months to find and catch eight animals to put radio collars on. And then I studied what they were doing, what they were eating, how they were actually interacting with each other. More ecology than behaviour. But, stuff like what sort of trees they preferred. So it was a lot of work.
Oh,
I spent a lot of time in the rainforest.
which is a beautiful place to be hanging out in, apart from when it's wet season. But
yes, absolutely. No, it was a tough gig.
So throughout the time of, well, one, why did you choose Lumholtz tree kangaroos? What did you want to find out? Like, what sparked your interest in that in the first place?
Oh, well, I used to live in Darwin. And I actually worked at the museum as a natural science collections manager. So when we decided to leave the hot, humid, horrible, I love Darwin, but it was very, very hot. So we decided to come to the Tablelands. And I jokingly, everybody said, oh, there's no museum there. What are you going to do for, you know, for a job? And I jokingly said, well, if I can't find a job in conservation, I will study tree kangaroos in my backyard. And I was kidding. But when I got here, I found out that there was very little known about them. And every time I asked anybody that, you know, around here, I'd ask them a question and they went, oh, we don't know. Oh, we don't know. And there was only two previous studies to mine. So, and they were both in curtain fig areas, so which is a lot different to our property. And so, yeah, I couldn't help myself. I wanted to know more about them. And I actually wanted to help in their conservation. So because this species, Lumholtz tree kangaroo, only occur in far north Queensland and nowhere else in the world, and not knowing anything about them, we can't look after them or keep them safe. So there you go. I embarked on a huge endeavour 20 years ago and started rescuing them as well, and then that's the I haven't stopped.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, with when you've got 28 in care, so Karen, what's going on there? Like, 28 is a lot of tree kangaroos. So
it is indeed. So when we first started rescuing them, we only actually got a couple of year. Sadly, they get hit by cars and killed by dogs. And that's, I'm talking domestic dogs. So the ones we hear about. So wild dogs would kill them in the wild, but we wouldn't hear about that because it's in the forest. But the ones we do hear about are usually, sadly, pets that can't help themselves, think that this funny little thing hopping along the ground, you know, I'll play with it. And that's enough. But anyway, we used to get a couple in a year that we would save and then release, and the occasional joey where mum was hit by a car or attacked by a dog and she had a joey. So sad, again, I keep saying the word sadly, sorry, but the last 8-9 years, the Tablelands, the same as the rest of Australia, has been going through drought. And when I first embarked on my PhD, we used to get 9 to 10 months of rain a year on the southern Tablelands. And people call it places like, you know, muddy Melanda and all sorts of things. And the locals understand that, but people that have just got here now think it's a norm to have what they call a dry season from winter right through till January. That's not normal for here. And it's really stressing the rainforest out. So 100 years ago, the southern Tablelands was solid rainforest. That's not very long ago, but we cleared it for timber. They came in for the red cedar to start with and then other timbers. And then they realised that it was volcanic. It's all a volcanic area, and thought that it was great farming land. So then everybody was, they actually had to clear a third of their land.
Wow.
By law. So we can't hold it against the original people here, but it continued. So we have now left these tiny little fragments of rainforest where the tree roos live. So Lumholtz tree kangaroos are very territorial and they live just in rainforest. And so when they've got these little tiny patches, they end up fighting, or, you know, the young ones have to find somewhere to go. And then they end up crossing paddocks and roads and getting hit by cars and the sorts. But on top of that, with this drought, the little patches, so normally rainforest won't dry out if it's a drought or a hot weather. If it's big enough, it'll only be the edge that'll dry. But these patches are small enough that they'll completely dry out, and the trees themselves are dying. So, and most of them don't have any water in them. So they're in the middle of a paddock if they're small ones. So we think what's happening is that we're getting more and more animals into care, and unfortunately they're coming in with a syndrome which we call central blindness. So these animals look healthy. They're otherwise nothing wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with their eyes, but they're turning up in really crazy places like service station workshops, Wow. We had one turn up in a plumbing section of the hardware shop right in town of Malanda.
Oh, wow.
One turned up and sat on the men's toilet seat in a cafe at Yungaburra. And just only a few weeks ago, one turned up in the art classroom at the high school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and wow. They'd lost. They can see, I always say they can see enough to get into trouble.
Yes.
So they can see, but their vision's poor and it's blurred vision and it's their depth perception is damaged. And we now know from working, I've been working with a veterinary ophthalmologist for the last 9 years and now with a veterinary pathologist at Charles Sturt University as well. So we know from samples that we've taken that there is actually damage to the optic nerve and brain behind the eye. And what's causing that, we don't know. Mm. So originally I thought that the drought was stressing the trees out, which I still think that, and we all agree with that. And rainforest trees are toxic, like a lot of trees. Like koalas have to deal with eucalypts. Tree kangaroos have to deal with some of the toxins and secondary compounds, they call them, in rainforest trees. Mm. Now, I think that when trees are stressed, we know, it's not just me thinking this, we know that when trees are stressed, they will actually increase their protection or, you know, the toxins in them, protect themselves, or because they're stressed, they just produce them naturally, or the lack of water will make them more concentrated. A good analogy that a friend pointed out to me is if you want chilies to be hotter, you stop watering your chili bush.
Oh.
And it will get, the chemicals in the chili will increase.
Wow.
Okay. So I love that analogy. It's such an easy one to understand. Mm. So whether it's a neurotoxin causing the damage or something else, we're unsure of at this stage, but we know that that's definitely causing stress to the animals. And that would, if it's not the neurotoxin causing the damage, it would at least cause their immune system to be lower so that they would get some sort of new virus or something. The strange thing is that if it is a virus, it's not contagious, it's not hereditary, and it's all over the tablelands. So normally when you get something like this new, it's usually clumped.
Okay.
So that in itself is a bit mysterious as well. So the whole thing is quite complex. And unfortunately, they're increasing. So last year, so we've gone from a couple a year to about 6 a year, and then last year we had 18 rescues.
Wow.
And from September till March is the season. So from usually, you know, just the end of winter right through till the beginning of autumn. And I guess because spring and summer, you know, animals are always more active and they're out looking for mates and things like that. But whether it's also that because that's the hot, dry weather that's causing the problems.
Yeah, right. Wow.
So from 18 in 18 weeks from September to Christmas we had. And every single one of those were blind.
Wow. Okay.
Yes.
And then that's when they get stuck in those tricky situations as well as dog attacks.
Yes, so that will then make them more vulnerable. So we get dog and car hits anyway because they're getting chased out and have to find a new home for healthy animals, but we don't know how many of these animals that are getting hit or killed by dogs were blind in the first place.
Okay.
I can tell if they're still alive. We can't tell unless we take samples if the damage is there. Because we have to see if they react to light and all sorts of things.
Okay.
So we can tell by their behaviour if they can't see properly, especially once I've got them here and I put them in an enclosure. You can really watch them, you know, trying to find their way around the enclosure. Once they know their enclosure, though, they will fool everybody. They're very smart animals. I'm biased, though, but they're very, very clever and they will just climb around and get to know their environment pretty easily.
Hmm.
Now, you might ask why we don't let them go then if they can get to know their environment. If they've got really bad depth perception, this is an animal that climbs up to 30 metres up a tree.
Mm.
That is really quite dangerous. And, of course, then they will get back into trouble because they'll end up either getting killed by dogs or they'll get chased out because, unfortunately, animals are cruel. So you know that if an animal of any sort has something wrong with it,
yes,
and it's in the wild, other animals will pick on it.
Yeah.
And that's just unfortunate. That's nature.
That's nature, yeah.
Yes.
So then with all the tree roos that you have at the moment, Karen, I know, like, I've known you for a while and I've been to your property and what you do is absolutely amazing and your property is stunning. With all those, I brought my own little rainforest patch just around the corner from you myself. So I'm really excited one day to be up there with you. But
well, absolutely. And you can come and help, Jodie. Yeah,
you can put a broom and a dustpan and brush in my hand. I'll help you out.
Would be great.
But with the huge amount of tree roots that you have, and you're saying that we can't put them back into the wild due to obvious reasons, you know, if they're blind, then they're just going to get themselves back into the same situation. What happens then? What are you doing with them? Or are zoos taking them? Or are you just going to house them until right to the end? And, you know, how does that work for you?
Well, we hope to get them into appropriate zoos. So they're quite difficult to look after in captivity. But once they're settled, it's just that they're a folivore. So for those out there that are listening, Lumholtz tree kangaroo, well, all tree kangaroos eat leaves. So that's why they love the rainforest and live in the rainforest. They went back up into the trees in their evolution and they live on leaves. So we have to go out and get a ute load every single day. And we try to give them a variety, and they're very fussy eaters. So it is tricky, but we have got some zoos that are taking them for us. And the good thing about that is that these animals then don't have to be just kept here or euthanized. They will be used for education. So as you said, most Australians don't know they exist. So to have them in a zoo and for people to understand who they are, what they are, and what's going on with them, then, as I've said before, is that you cannot save a species unless people know about them.
Yeah.
And it's not, I also want to go back and just quickly say that it's not the only tree kangaroo there is. We have two unique species in Australia. There's another species north of the Dane tree called Bennett's, and those also only occur in Australia. And then in Papua New Guinea and Indonesia, they have another 12 species and subspecies, which are amazing and very, very unique. They're sadly all endangered because they're still hunted, as well as being rainforest being cleared for mining and all sorts of things. So,
yeah, I've actually got a story on the Papua New Guinea one. My dad worked in Papua New Guinea for around about 11 years. And when he first started working there, he worked in an area called Kutubu. And my dad loved to go walk about all the time. He just loved the forest. His soul was in there. And so he would go walking around, looking at things, and he got to know some of the local villagers. Now, those specific local villagers were, like, how do you explain it? Like, real villagers, like,
yes,
you know, and so nobody.
Very original, yes.
Very, very original. So Dad actually used to trade, and he loved to sort of sit around the fire with them or just try and communicate and learn some of the language. And he used to trade his cigarettes for time spent with them. So one day after a couple of years in Kutubu, he actually went for a walk around and they hunted a tree roo. And so he traded the tree roo's life for every bit of packet of cigarettes he could find or anything he could give them to release the tree roo, probably knowing very well that they would go back and get it. But that was just their food there. Yes. So they were eating it. But also at one stage, my dad leant against a tree and hit a trip wire, one of the big bird-eating spiders, and and got him on the hand. And he turned around to say to the people he was with, what is that? They were running, and he woke up 3 weeks later. He woke up 3 weeks later. They couldn't even get him to Cairns. He had to to Port Moresby Hospital. Someone was trying to save his life there, all from that spider. But the village actually saved his life. When they were running, they were actually running to get help because they knew what happened. So he was very lucky to have been with them. But, yeah, the tree roo there was something that he always told me that story over and over again. But knowing that that's just them hunting traditionally and for that particular village, high up, like yes, in sort of like that forest. So
do you know what species of tree kangaroo it was?
No, he never knew what it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. It'd be interesting. Yeah. There's 12 in Papua New Guinea.
Yes, there are. So they think what happened is they think they originated in Australia. So they believe that Bennett's and Lumholtz are the more, if you'd like to say, primitive species. Ooh. And that when we are joined to New Guinea and when the water was not there and we had a land bridge, they moved to New Guinea and there's a lot more, there's a lot of different rainforests in New Guinea. So they believe that that speciation occurred where you get they call it irradiation, where you get lots of species coming from the originals, and that's because they're in different types of habitats. Well, that's what I've been led to believe anyway.
Yeah.
But with evolution, I was always taught that if you have like lots of species, that's not where they originally came from. But they've had that opportunity to fill all those niches. And yes, they are a delicacy in New Guinea. They find them difficult to catch, but they do for ceremonies and sometimes it just if they need the protein. So there are people in New Guinea, there's a couple of different non-for-profits over there trying to get the clans, the different villages, as you said, to set aside non-hunting areas so that the animals' numbers can increase again. And an interesting story I can tell you is that one of the researchers that was over there, an American guy, brought some elders, some New Guineans, here to Australia, and they'd never been out of the mountains.
Wow.
So it was quite a cultural shock for them. And then he took them to America, which would have been even scarier for them. But I took them radio tracking here when I was doing my PhD, and they called me Superwoman because I could find the tree roots. So I thought that was something I like to share.
Oh, because when you think of it, like you mentioned, they can be up to 30 meters high. I can't imagine that they would be very easy hunting for certain villages and clans in Papua New Guinea. So, but even here, I know when we go walking around and we're trying to look for tree roots, my neck hurts because you're constantly looking up. And then Matt's like, yeah, you just look for a tail hanging down. I'm like, what, with all the vines and everything everywhere? Like, it's actually really hard to find a tree root.
And yeah, I can tell you 100 stories about that. So I had a constantly bad neck the whole 5 years I was doing my study. Even with radio collars on, I would spend up to 3 hours because I had to find them to say exactly what tree they were up for what I wanted to show. And you would only just have to step 6 inches one way and then you'd go, oh, there's an ear, you know.
Wow.
And they like to hide from us too. So some places you go, they'll be sitting out in the open and you'll go, oh, great, this is easy. But I have walk directly underneath one, and that's another funny story. I was radio tracking one in fairly short regrowth in our property up the front, and I got all tangled up in miller vine.
Oh, so I was gonna say, wait a while.
That too, but this particular time was just lots and lots of miller vine, and I was, you know, had the beep beep beeps, so I have to go through here, and I was swearing and cursing, and I had a big backpack on my back and the antenna, I had to fold it up to get through, and I'm and I got through the vine and got to the other side and opened up my antenna, and there was no beep, and I went, oh, you know, a really faint one. I went, was here. I turned around and the tree kangaroo was sitting above my head and if he'd had his tail down, he would have hit me in the face. And he was just looking at me as if to say, oh, what are you doing? You know, because the poor thing would have been shaken, you know, tremendously with me trying to get through the vines. So that just shows how easy they are to miss.
Yeah, but, absolutely. Perfect camouflage with their coloration there.
Absolutely.
So, Karen, what come up for me before is how many different species of plants or trees do they eat? Because you're saying that you go out and get a variety. Do you know how many, or does, you know, the research show how many different varieties?
Well, we have, with observations of other people and myself, we've identified about 140 species that they like in the rainforest. When I looked at what they specifically liked, they're actually individually fussy, of course, but there is about a dozen or so that are their favourites. But individually, one next to the other might have one species available to it and doesn't like it, and the other one loves it. So what's difficult for us when we're feeding them is, like, I went out the other day and chopped what I feel like was half a tree of a species called sarsaparilla, it was flowering, and it's one of their favourites. It's a pioneer species. And I thought, oh, wow, it's flowering. I'll cut a heap for them. And a couple of them went, oh, yeah, great, for 5 minutes. And then they just all stopped eating it. And I went, oh, great, thanks, guys. So
yeah, that's how I feel as a mother. Every time I put it on the table.
Yes, I bet. Yeah, so, and they'll even go right down the branch to smell each leaf.
Oh, wow.
And go, you know, oh, no, I don't want that today.
And
oh, come on. But there is a couple of introduced species that we use that they absolutely love, and they trash it. So they don't know their privets and they don't know them in the wild. So people say to me, oh, well, they eat on the edge of the rainforest or the edge of the road because they like it. And I went, no. They've never seen that. Some of them have, you know, in creeks and springs and things like that where it's been disturbed. Mm. But most of the guys from the rainforest don't know any of the introduced species or anything that we feed them that they aren't native. Yeah. So they take a little bit to get used to them, but once they like them or even to try them, once they've tried them, then for us it's a great thing because I can go out and get a ute load of privet, and especially when it's flowering, mm. and they will just, I'll end up with sticks the next day, which is wonderful because then they've got a lovely full stomach and they're all happy. So,
and what is their digestive system like? Is it like koala or?
They're not. So koalas are what they call a hindgut fermenter, and their stomachs are quite small, but they have a really large cecum or appendix. Our appendix is only little. So in the koalas and a lot of the other animals like possums and even horses have this massive big cecum, and it does, so when they're eating foliage or leaves or grass, as in horses, it ferments in the bacteria in that part of the gut. With tree kangaroos and other macropods, so all macropods are full gut fermenters, that means their stomach is larger and sort of has these folds in it. Mm. And that gives them surface area. So it's full of bacteria, often full of worms, and that's natural for the tree roos, and that's where they actually ferment the leaves. So with normal kangaroos, they've got quite an elongated stomach, and they can eat lots and lots and lots and lots of grass, and what they don't eat just passes through. Mm. It's difficult to digest, but it's not poisonous. So, but tree kangaroos, because they're dealing with leaves that are harder to digest and they've got thick cuticles and they've got toxins in them, they've actually got a really large sack-like stomach. It's 25% of their body weight.
Wow.
So when you see this big tummy on a tree kangaroo, they're not a big fat tree kangaroo. They're just a very well-fed tree kangaroo with a full stomach. And that ferments. So they chew and grind the leaves down into small particles or small fragments, and the bacteria then attacks it and helps digest it. Mm. And then they can pass it through the rest of their system and digest those leaves. So, yeah, it's very interesting. And I did a whole chapter on their digestive system and then another one on their teeth. So they're definitely designed for eating leaves.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, when I do the education with the kids in school, when we talk about even just looking at an animal's teeth, it gives you a really great clue, obviously, of what they eat. So, yeah, so what do tree roos have?
Tree roos' teeth are almost identical to koalas.
Okay.
So they have a flat tooth row. Yep. So that means like ours, their teeth are flat, yep. as in they touch, all of them touch at once. And they have the normal macropod and diprotodon, two incisors at the bottom and two at the top. Well, they actually have four, but the two big ones and six actually, I had to think then. And then they have four molars, but in front of the molars they have this massive big tooth called a premolar, and that's what they bite with. So they can even bite sticks, and so they certainly hurt if they get your finger back there when they're biting. But it starts off as two little teeth they call deciduous teeth, and then that's replaced with this massive big premolar when they're about 2.5 years of age.
Yeah, right.
And the problem with the teeth like that, and koalas are the same, is that they wear. And as they get older, their teeth wear, and then they can't grind the leaves well enough. So that's when, sadly, their age comes into it, and that's when we lose them.
A very quick announcement to make that I'm so excited. Our home education virtual portal is up and running, and you can visit that at www.australianwildlifeeducation.com. And if you are a parent or you know other parents who have children ages 4 to 12, this one is specifically for them, and they get to learn more about Australian wildlife. Yeah. And so how long do tree kangaroos live for?
Well, I thought with my study, I found that the wild ones live to about 14, 15 years of age, and that they can live up to 20 in captivity. So we help them with, you know, softer food when they're in captivity as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that with all species or is it species dependent? Like,
Oh, that's Slumholtz. I'm not quite sure about the other species. Yeah.
Yeah.
How many, I would say Bennett's would be pretty similar. But when there's no Bennett's in captivity anywhere in the world.
No, yes, I have heard that. So yes, it's just the Lumholtz. But how many tree kangaroos worldwide are there, did you say? I can't remember if you said it earlier.
Well, there's the 12 in New Guinea and 2 in Australia, so 14.
Yes.
And it depends who you ask. So the 12 in New Guinea, some of those is what they call subspecies. So I think that's the IUCN's most recent thing is there's 12.
Mm.
So 14 altogether.
Yeah, and is the Lumholtz and the Bennett's listed as vulnerable, threatened, endangered? What is the list out there at the moment? Because I know it got changed.
Yes, a few years back it went up and down and went a bit crazy. The Queensland government was playing with their listings, but they are now classed as near threatened.
Mm.
In my belief, especially with the increased number of blind animals, they definitely should be up around the vulnerable mark. Yeah, the reason that they won't put them higher is that we don't have enough information on their populations.
Yeah.
And the reason we don't have enough information on their populations is that they're so hard to find to count.
Yes.
And it's near impossible. So, as I said, you can walk straight under one.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily an edge species, which a lot of people say they are. I found that they weren't. So, and when we go, you know, humans are an edge species. So when you're going looking for them, you're often on the edge of the rainforest. Very difficult to find them in thick rainforest and spotlighting especially, because they just hide behind a leaf.
And
then that's it. You're looking for, you know, you've got all this reflection of your spotlight.
So, but please tell us how a kangaroo can climb up to 30 metres. Like, explain a little bit about its adaptations of being up, because I mean, I look at one and you just think, I do not understand how you don't fall out the tree all the time, and how do you balance, and how do you even get up and down again? So,
oh, yeah, it's pretty amazing. And I mean, the males get to 12 and a half kilos. And the females, you know, I've had a female 10 and a half kilos. So that's quite it doesn't sound a lot really, but it's quite a large animal to be sitting up in a tree. They can scare you. They can get right out on these small limbs and you go, oh, come on, you're going to break that. But they are adapted to life in the trees and it's pretty amazing. They're a stockier build than other kangaroos and they've got these massive, big, muscly arms. I actually call, you know, other kangaroos' arms Tyrannosaurus Rex arms compared to tree rings. And you can actually pick tree kangaroos up by the arms, which is pretty, when I hand raise them, of course, not a wild one.
Yeah.
But that, and people look at me and go, oh my God, you'll hurt them. And I said, no, they climb with these arms.
Yes.
But the arms are really, really muscly and short, and they have these massive big claws on them. Now, the back legs are shorter and stockier than a normal kangaroo. And then they've got these much shorter fat, really quite short fat, padded back feet, and their padding's quite soft and squishy. And they, if it's a scientific term there. yeah, that helps them with traction and grip. And those back feet, even though they're exactly the same as other kangaroos' feet with the toes and everything, they're just shorter and fatter. But they can turn them inwards and that helps them go up and down tree trunks. So they can go up a completely vertical tree trunk. And, yeah, it's kind of hard to explain how they do it, but it's sort of, they kind of jump up the trees but with their feet on the side of the trees.
Ah, yeah.
Sort of like a timber cutterwood, or you see some of them overseas going up trees to get coconuts.
Yes, I was going to say, I just imagine someone doing the coconut.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
Yep.
Now, when they come down, they slide their back feet down like a fireman down a pole.
Right.
But they also, something really unique to tree kangaroos is that they can actually walk bipedal. So a lot of people say kangaroos can walk, but they use all five limbs, including their tail. Tree kangaroos can walk on their back feet, so they can move their back legs independently.
Oh.
And it looks really weird. And
wow.
It's a bit, I filmed three of my joeys walking around the care center up in the hospital area, and they look like velociraptors walking around. Because they hold their tail up. They don't use their tail for walking like other kangaroos. So they kind of hold them curled up like rock wallabies.
Wow.
So they don't like their tails touching the ground very often.
I actually didn't know that. Now I want to see how they do that. That's amazing.
You'll have to go to my Facebook page and watch the video. No, I'll send you the video.
Yes, no, I will. And everyone else listening there, I'll put your Facebook page in the podcast notes there and people can click on that and go and check out some amazing stuff that you have on your Facebook there.
Yeah, no, when they walk, I tell people they can walk and they go, oh, yeah. And then when they see it, they just go, oh my God, I didn't think you meant properly, like bipedal. So they're up on their back legs and they waddle. I call it a waddle. And it helps them. You don't see them doing it in the wild a lot because they're usually hanging onto branches and eating and doing stuff. Or they use all four legs to climb along. But they still move those back legs one at a time. And they can go backwards. So I have a really cool video of one of mine in the house. So we've got a couple of teenagers in the house because we don't have enough room for them at the moment in cages. And he goes to the front door and looks out. He's blind, but he can see brightness and he can smell the wild.
Yep.
And then he backs up and then walks forward and then backs up. And I've actually got that on my Facebook page with the beep, 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 beep of a reversing truck to it. So I've got another one at the moment, a little girl that I keep telling her that her reverse is stuck. Because she reverses all the way back from the door right to the lounge. And it's just boredom, I think. So when they go out in the enclosures, they won't do it as much.
Yeah.
But this walking bit and being able to reverse backwards like that helps them along branches. And so it's very unique.
Yes.
So they are totally adapted to tree life in the trees. They're very slow. They're faster than me, but they're very slow on the ground, which makes them more vulnerable to dog attacks.
Yeah, definitely.
So they will hop across a paddock in the middle of the day. So that's the other thing, before I forget, they're not nocturnal. So
yes.
Everything you read on the internet, and I've had so many people disagree with me on Facebook, they are not nocturnal. They're active day and night, and not just because I have them here in captivity, but that is I followed them around during the day in my PhD. So they will come down, hop across the rainforest, go up another tree, and they'll eat, sleep all day and all night. And it's actually, there's a term for it and it's called cathemeral.
Oh.
So it's a new term. It took me a while to find it.
Cathemeral.
I've known it since I did my PhD. I looked it up. But it means that they're active to do what they have to for life.
Yes.
And then they have these little naps. Now, I myself have called them power naps because, yeah, they'll have a 20-minute sleep and then they're off again. Off we go. And they're very active when they're active. They're not. They're different to koalas that they're not sleepy all the time. They're very, very active.
So what's that word again? Cathemeral.
Yes.
I think Matt might be cathemeral.
Yes. He just has power naps every now and then. That's
power nap.
Absolutely. I think a lot of animals are cathemeral that we know of. And I think a lot of the macropods, especially the rainforest ones. So why, when you're walking through the rainforest during the day, you don't often see the other macropods like paddy melons. But if they're used to you, you will. So, I mean, here, most of the native animals here, I don't go into the thick rainforest and disturb them now, but the ones closer to the house, the paddies will be chasing each other around and being silly during the day too. So it just depends. What my belief is because it's usually quite darkish in the rainforest, it doesn't matter whether it's day or night to
them. Yes, yeah.
It's obviously darker at night, but they just need to eat and do things. And then, as I said, they must have a nap every now and then. It's not helpful for me when I'm hand raising them, though.
No,
because they just have a power nap and then they go, oh, I'm awake again. So, I'm not. Can I?
A bunch of little kids. Oh, my God.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
So what is a tree kangaroo's purpose in an ecosystem? What do they contribute to, or what's the, yeah. So, you know, a lot of people sort of say, well, why are crocodiles important, or what do koalas even do anyway? But do tree kangaroos have something specific?
Well, look, you could say that they're important in the rainforest because they are. You know, I actually find it really difficult to answer questions like that, not just for tree kangaroos, but like you said, koalas.
Yes.
And people go, well, why are they important? Well, why are we important? I always say, well, every species is important. They have their special place in the rainforest, and whether we know it, what they're doing or not. But one thing you could say is that they're actually Australia's answer to the monkeys. So you could, in the end, that's their niche of that's what, you know, they're fulfilling that type of role They don't eat a lot of fruit, so I wouldn't say that they're spreading the seeds or the fruit. But if they do, they could. You know, they could be doing that. They could be unknown to us. They could be pollinating.
Well, that's it. I mean, when you think of their movement in the forest and maybe even the disturbance of the tree branches and the leaves and certain seeds or, you know, pollination needs to happen with wind or with movement of some sort. So, and I find this interesting, Karen, where you personally have worked with them now for 20 years. And I guess like people who work in a care environment or they're out there like Jane Goodall sitting in the rainforest researching the chimpanzees, you really, really get to see and understand every aspect of, and it's interesting, you said before, the internet isn't always correct. I was shocked to hear that, Karen.
But
it's like people like yourself, even me having, say, my bearded dragon for 15 years and watching it and viewing it, but being around it all the time, like, you know, I've been around lots of animals all the time. It's not just little snippets where you're going out into the forest and you're sitting there for 3 hours and you're leaving. A lot of people follow these animals or be amongst these animals 24/7 for years at a time, and that's when the good stuff comes out of the research, because you finally get to see what a tree root does in January isn't what they would do in June and isn't what they're going to eat and isn't going to be where they're found. And you know, that's the case with so much of our wildlife. We actually really don't know that much when you really dig deep. I mean, they're even changing information about the cassowary as we speak. More and more people are researching about the cassowary. Back 20 years ago, it was thought of, you know, being so important for only 50 species of rainforest trees, and now they're saying 150 or more. And again, that research is going to show us. So the importance of the tree kangaroo, I feel that give yourself another 20 years, Karen, and you're going to find more and more and more information that we had no idea about, and their importance and, you know, their sort of place within that ecosystem, within the chain and the thread and the web and everything. So it would be really interesting to find out more of their, you know, purpose in the environment. There's your next PhD. There's your next.
No, one PhD was enough, thanks. You're absolutely right. And one of the things I say to people is that when people do studies of any sort, they often, like you said, they often go and spend maybe a few weeks in the forest or a week or two, whatever, and then they go back to the uni and then they spend some time on the computer and then go back and do more. I lived here, so my study site was in my backyard.
Yeah.
And so I went out and I felt like I had to. I felt like I can't just sit here. I've got to go and look for a tree root and do stuff.
Yeah.
So I spent 7 days a week for 5 years in the forest.
Definitely. And that's
important. And different times of day and night. So I would randomly, you'll laugh at this, I would sit and watch a scary movie on the TV and then go, oh, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. I'll go out and radio track and, you know, crazy stuff like that. Yes, it did scare me once. So I would stop doing that on my own. But I've actually say to people now that 5 years, yes, I got a snippet into what they do in the wild. But since we've been rescuing them and since we've had so many different ages and age groups and personalities, and every single tree kangaroo has a different personality, absolutely, I have learnt more in the last 15 years, but we've been doing it for 20 as well as my PhD, of looking after them.
Yeah, exactly.
So having them in care, even though you would think that they'd act differently in captivity, but I still find out so much more. The walking.
Mm.
I mean, you know, I think it was said a long time ago that they could move their back legs independently, but to see them and film them actually up on their back legs walking, which, as I said, you don't catch them do that in the wild because it's often hard to see them. What I found when I was radio tracking them is as soon as you found them, they would stop and watch you. So anything they're doing, they would just sit and go, oh, there's somebody watching me. I'm just going to sit here.
Yeah.
And they would stop eating or they would stop doing whatever. So even if you sneak up on them, you don't sneak up on an animal in the rainforest. They hear you coming from a mile away.
Oh, absolutely.
But as I said, I think even though we can't pinpoint exactly why they're important in the rainforest, I think every species that lives in the rainforest is important. It's there, not necessarily for a reason, but has evolved to live there. And I don't think it's up to us to say that this animal's more important than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so I really, even though I search and search in my head, you know, why people ask me it all the time, you know, why are they so important? Because they're a tree kangaroo and they're the only, this animal doesn't occur anywhere else in the world.
No.
This species, Lundholz, only occurs on the Atherton Tablelands.
Oh, my
God.
So goodness.
It is important, you know.
Yes, yes, I agree. I mean, how unique is it that there's a kangaroo in a tree up to 30 metres high? They are perfectly designed for life in the trees, and that adaptation is amazing. But it's not only that physical adaptation that we can see. It's the behaviour adaptations and then obviously the physiological side of things as well. But I think what I love about wildlife and nature and ecosystems and habitats is I'm so curious as to how, why, what, and I'm constantly asking these questions. And then, you know, I've been in the industry too or with working amongst it for 20 years and every single day without fail I find something new. Like,
oh, absolutely. Like,
even about the animals, I've got my own private zoo that I travel to do wildlife talks with students in classes. And even the animals that I have there, like my black-headed python or my bearded dragon or a little sugar glider or something like that, even though I've had them for so long, there's something new that I'm finding out. And I'm like, hang on a minute, I didn't know that happened. Now, that's a really interesting behaviour. And just even documenting it. And I'll even say, like, I had a little freshwater crocodile that was a young one. I think it was around about 8 months of age. And it did have the little stones in its belly because in its tank, it had the small little pebbles down the bottom. And, you know, there's a lot of research out there for why do crocodiles have stones and why do they eat them? Anyway, it was really interesting. And I've never been able to find any documentation on this, but I had to move the crocodile into an outside pond because it was time for it to, you know, it's safe out there now, outside pond. And it actually, I found the rocks at the bottom of the pond because I hadn't quite finished the enclosure. I put him in there, got some sun, and it was just a plain sort of black bottom. And there were the pebbles. So I don't know if
he
regurgitated them or pooed them out, but it was with that movement from one to another. And is that stress or is it, you know, this, that. And so even that is like there's still research out there to try and find out exactly why they have that. And there's been research on crocodiles for a long time now.
I had a question for you then. Did you leave the pebbles in there and did he eat them again?
I actually left the pebbles in there and he did not eat them again. No, he never did ever again. So we thought maybe he did, but then eventually after a while we moved him into his bigger one again further. But you could actually feel them in his belly too. But I think working with animals, working in, I mean, zoos play an important role if they are obviously done properly.
Yes.
There are an important role for zoos for education, but it is important that they are, our animals are displayed in an appropriate
naturally
manner. Yes, definitely.
Absolutely. I want people to know we are very fussy about what zoos take Lundholz tree kangaroos.
Yes.
And it's not an easy process. I don't just go, right, I'm going to take them to this zoo.
Yes.
We have to go through quite a lot of paperwork and a lot of work to get them into these zoos. And one of those reasons is because I'm so fussy about who takes them and why. And those zoos have to send zookeepers here to learn how to look after them. I'm very, very, I'm very fussy about them because if they're not looked after well, they will get sick. Yeah. And then why keep them in captivity if you're not going to look after them properly?
Well, and that's
so,
it.
But when you were talking about learning about, I learned something new all the time like you. And I always say to people when they say, do you know everything about tree kangaroos? I go, no way.
No.
And I say, I learned something new. And I think when people say to me, you know, occasionally you'll get a person that will say, I know everything about this. And you go, well, you've stopped learning.
Yes, perfect.
If you think that you're not learning something new every day and go, wow, that's, I didn't know that, then if you're not open to that, you've stopped learning. And then that's just, you know.
Yes.
My favourite saying.
Love that. Like, we've got at home, we've got like so many books, it's ridiculous. And we have that curiosity and those questions. And we're like, hang on a minute, why is this? So the next minute, you know, we've got all our beautiful big books. We don't go to the internet because the internet is full of all sorts. So we go to our...
Oh, but you told me you were disappointed when I said the internet was not always right.
I was being facetious there, Karen.
I know.
Right? Oh, but it's just that curiosity, the questions. If you stop being curious, if you stop asking questions, then you're right, Karen, like you've stopped learning. And right to the, you know, you can see the tree root behind me and the eclectic carrots and the cassowary there, like striped possum. People don't even know what a striped possum is.
There's
so many
green possums. Green possums as
green
well.
Green possums, I know. Yes. I saw one not long ago. Beautiful.
Oh, they're absolutely awesome.
Seriously, Australia has the most amazing animals and unique as well. And absolutely. I tell you what, Karen, I've really enjoyed our chat today. I could ask you a billion more questions, but we are coming to the end of the hour. So what I think I might do is get you back on again somewhere down the track, because I know that there will be questions that people will probably ask that maybe we can get you back on. But where can everyone find you? Can I direct them into the right place? How can they help you with maybe raising some money? I know on your website, we've got your shirts, we've got your tree roos, we've got all sorts of things that we get from your website. Can you let us know some details?
Well, I have a very active Facebook page. Do have an Instagram page, but sadly I find I just don't have time to do everything. So I try to put stuff up on a regular basis on Facebook. And yeah, I try to put some interesting videos, and in those videos I do what I can to inform people, you know, of stuff that we've learned and what's happening here. The other thing is that people can go to our website, which is trirurescue.org.au. And as you said, we have a shop. You can adopt a tree kangaroo, you can buy merchandise, and all of that goes to us helping the tree roos. Yeah. So for people who don't realise, a sanctuary like us, we do fully rely on donations. We don't get government support. Neil and I do not get a wage. We do not get paid by the government to do what we do. And we work 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Yes.
And I occasionally get a couple of days off if I'm lucky, but I need somebody in here to look after the, particularly I have a couple of really naughty ones that I don't let volunteers deal with because, you know, some of the boys can be a bit naughty. So, yeah, so people can just straightforward donate. But the adoptions are pretty cool. So you get a certificate and a photo story of the animal, which is, they make really good Christmas presents.
Yeah.
And just a really exciting thing, I don't know if you wanted to share this, but the Jane Goodall Institute have just done a really cool kids book. And I'm very excited to say that they've included Lumholtz Tree Kangaroo.
Yes.
Which really shocked me, but I'm so excited about it. And there's a lot of postings at the moment, and I did a video for that, and I explain, and I have a couple of tree kangaroos in my arms. Well, one was asleep, the other one was on my shoulder. But yeah, and we sort of talk about tree roos a bit in that too. Yes. And if people want to go to the link, which will be up on Facebook very soon, they can buy the books for Christmas, and they're really cute. They talk all about lots of threatened and iconic species in Australia. And that book, if it's sold between now and the end of September on our link, we get the retail margin of it.
Awesome.
Which is pretty cool. Yeah. So, but yes, there's lots of ways people can help. The other ways I like people to know that they can help individually, if they can't afford to help us out, well, then they can do things like keep their dogs under control. When I say under control, I don't mean just standing beside you and it will do what it's told. If you're walking around near rainforest on the Atherton Tablelands or even far up near the Daintree, please keep them on a lead. If you can, fence them in, and that will stop lots of wildlife from being hurt.
Yeah.
Where regardless of whether you think it or not, your puppy dog, as even a fluffy one, will chase animals like tree kangaroos, and even just the chase is enough to stress them out. But if they get hold of them, they will actually kill them. And when you're driving around, because they're not nocturnal, please watch out for them day and night. And if anybody does see one that's lost or displaced or looking a bit, you know, that it doesn't know where it is, or it injured, hit by a car, or if your dog does attack a tree kangaroo, just ring us, and our number is on Facebook and our website.
Excellent. And what I'll do is I'll put all those details in the podcast notes so everyone can click the links and go directly to you, Karen. And I think that's important that we understand that change actually happens at home, like individually within our own place, you know. we can do our one little bit or our bit for nature, then together we're actually changing things and we're changing the world, and that we're working towards a better world for nature and stuff like that, and for ourselves, of course. So I love that. Thank you for the advice, Karen. It was perfect.
Oh, no, absolutely. And look, I always just say to people, there's so many simple things that you can do. Everyone goes, oh, well, what difference does it make? Well, if we all do it, so please, you know, the usual stuff. Don't use single-use plastics. Be kind to the environment. Try and do whatever you can to help with climate change. And then hopefully we won't get so many tree kangaroos in each year that are blind. Yes. So, yeah, I think everybody can do something. And if you can, if you can't and you want to plant a tree, there's a lot of rainforest organisations that will plant trees for you.
Yes.
Yeah, so there's actually quite a lot that people can do. My biggest thing is be kind to the environment, and you're going to be helping a lot of species.
Absolutely, absolutely. And exactly what somebody said to me and what is in my podcast introduction is that, you know, we may not be able to change the world individually with ourselves,
yes,
but together by doing little things, we change the world. You know, it just starts with you. It starts with you at home. And on that note, Karen, thank you so much for talking to us. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, no, I'm glad. Like I said to you, is I could probably talk to you all day.
I'll get you on again for sure.
Absolutely. And if you ever want to do a video with the animals, I'll be happy to do that too. Oh,
I think I need to come up and hang out with you, do some videos, put it on Australian Wildlife Education YouTube channel, and then everyone can also see the amazing work that you're doing, and hopefully we can raise some more awareness behind everything that we've talked about. But hopefully everyone enjoyed learning a little bit more about tree kangaroos, our unique animal here in North Queensland, Cairns, Australia, and we are truly lucky to have some amazing wildlife. But Karen, I'm going to say goodbye, and I hope you have a wonderful day. I know that you've been busy all morning, so hopefully you get a bit of lunch and then you're probably back out there caring for those beautiful tree kangaroos.
Well, I've got two little joeys that are probably dying of thirst right now, that they're due for a bottle right now. So
right now, perfect timing. Yes. Well, you go do that, and I'm going to speak to you soon. Much love to you and Neil, and we'll speak to you later.
Thanks, Jodie. You have a good day too, and thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
I really hope you enjoyed that episode with Dr. Karen Coombs and learning more about tree kangaroos. I certainly did. And it's a little bit daunting, I believe, to find out exactly the threats that we have going on for our tree kangaroos, and still to this day not really knowing and understanding the reason behind a lot of the blindness that is happening. So if you would like to find out more information or get in contact with Dr. Karen Coombs, please visit her website, that is treeroorescue.org.au, and see exactly how we can help. Now just remember, donations are important. However, money is, I believe, the easy way for us to contribute to wildlife and conservation. But what are you doing at home to create a change? What are you doing in your day-to-day activities and behaviours to create a change? Yes, donations are needed, but also the change needs to happen. So please get in contact, see how you can help. You may even be able to volunteer or maybe do something else in regards to education to help spread the word. But remember, it all starts with you. So guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. I'll speak to you on the next Wild Chat.